Hello, welcome to your meditation practice as part of the Open Heart Project. My name is Susan Piver. I am very happy to sit with you in meditation. We're going to sit together for 10 minutes and we're going to start soon. So please take your seat, get settled, whether you're on a cushion on the floor with your legs crossed loosely in front of you, if possible. Kneeling is also fine, by the way. Or you can sit in a chair or on the sofa. There is no inherent spiritual value in this cushion, as opposed to on a chair. So whatever enables you to sit comfortably and upright is good. And as you get settled, I want to continue our conversation about the Noble Eightfold Path, the eight steps that you can take, or I can take, that anyone could take, to liberate oneself from suffering. And when oneself is liberated from suffering, the opportunity to help others become liberated is vastly increased. Now, these steps, as you may know, are associated with the Buddha Dharma, the Buddhist path, but they're inherently religion-free, if you ask me. You don't have to be a Buddhist or believe in anything or to make this wisdom your own. In fact, making this wisdom your own is at the heart of Buddhism and at the heart of every genuine spiritual path, as far as I understand them, but I digress. So right now we are on step five of the Eightfold Path. We started with right view, which is seeing things clearly, which is extremely helpful. And here, seeing things clearly doesn't mean being wise or understanding. It means seeing beyond conventional mind to the deeper truth of reality. Tall order, but what else are you going to do with your life? Step two, right intention, which naturally arises from the right view. When you see things clearly, your impulse to offer something is rooted in reality. So that's good too. Third, my personal favorite, right speech. How can we use what comes out of our pie hole to create more goodness in the world? Now, creating more goodness doesn't mean being sweet and nice and using your words to say complimentary things. I mean, sometimes it does, but sometimes right speech is calling something out or being silent. But when you have the right view, you see clearly, and you have the intention to be of benefit, right speech naturally arises in the most relevant way. Then we come to number four, right action, which is having some sense of morality and ethics in the way you move through the world. Not according to a belief system, I just want to be clear about that. And not by trying to aspire to some ideal that someone else told you was correct, but by weighing the truth of your words, of course, your decisions, your offerings, so that they bring benefit, not just to you, which is very important, don't get me wrong, but to all beings. That's important too. Right view and right intention set the ground for the Noble Eightfold Path, which leads to liberation from suffering. Without those two, it's pretty much hit or miss. The next steps, including right speech, right action, right livelihood, and then the next one, right effort, are about how do you bring this into the world? How do you interact with the world? Speech, of course, is one of the primary ways we interact with the world, communication, whether it's oral or written. The actions we take, of course, should be aligned with our view and our intention. And now we come to right livelihood. What do we do in the world? To make money, to express ourselves, to support ourselves and others. It's very important. I know that wasn't a very good talk. It's very important. I'm just trying to think where to start. So I guess what comes to my mind first is, why are we even working with our minds in meditation to do these things, view, intention, speech, and so on? How does this practice help with this path? Very good question. And of course, it's at the root of the effectiveness of the path. And here's one reason why I say that. So when it comes to the places where we spend most of our time, which for many people is at home with a family member or partner or children, whoever you live with, if you live with someone else, and at work. What you do every day for a living. That's where we spend the most time. And in these places where we spend the most time, invest the most, pay the most attention, complain the most, delight the most, whatever it may be, eventually, and this is quite true of relationships, but also I would say of the workplace, the boundary between ourselves and the people in our home and the people we work with or the situations at work begins to shimmer. It begins to become less distinct. We attribute to the people we're close to at home or at work the qualities of our own mind in the way we interact with them. And that can result in things like talking to the people in our homes or at our workplace in a way we would never talk to anyone else. We feel some sort of license to get angry, to, I don't know what, call people out, to gossip, whatever it is that we feel licensed to do. Because, not because you're a bad person, I'm sure you're a very good person, but because the way we talk to ourselves becomes the way we talk to others. When the boundary gets more and more indeterminate, as happens when we spend a lot of time in a place or with a person, the way we talk to ourselves starts to become the way we talk to others. And I don't know about you, but the way I talk to myself is often very aggressive, not good, demeaning. No. So we work with our minds on the cushion so that we can change our self-talk, which then changes the way we talk to others. So when it comes to right livelihood, the way we talk to others in the workplace is of unbelievable importance. I used to work in the music business a million years ago, and especially back then, but maybe still so, I don't know. It was a field of outlaws, basically. You didn't have to have a degree to work in the music business. You just like had some street smarts, you had some ideas, you were lucky. Oh, guess what? Now you're the head of a company or the head of marketing, whatever it is. I think that's changed. But back then it was like, you know, a bunch of cowboys, so to speak. And I had the good and bad fortune to encounter some very brilliant people who had unbelievably great ideas and contributed, in fact, to the genesis of entire forms of music that we now just are mainstream and take for granted and so on. They're smart, they understand numbers, they have great connections, whatever. That, oh, I'd say all or almost all of those businesses failed at some point because, you know, businesses fail at some point. And none of them failed because that person wasn't smart or because their ideas suddenly were revealed to be bad ideas. They were smart and their ideas were great. Most businesses fail or workplace situations tank because somebody took my pencils and I don't like that. Or so-and-so said something in a meeting that I thought was my idea. Now I'm really upset. Okay, those are very ordinary things. Not the pencils, those are kind of extraordinary now. But what I'm trying to say is the things that make our livelihood workable, part of our path, has a lot to do with the way we communicate and relate to others. I hope I'm not babbling here. I hope I'm making a point that's useful to you. And being able to do that begins with being able to work with our own minds first, which is what we're doing when we meditate. So traditionally, just going back to tradition, not pencils and music and so on, right livelihood began, as did right speech with what not to do. Don't lie, no abusive speech, and so on. Right livelihood is considered avoiding things that harm other beings, working in situations where you have to harm others, humans, animals, any others, trafficking in weapons, don't do that. Trafficking in poisons, don't do that either, and so on. So, okay, That's where we start. No poisons. Try not to work in a place that harms others. It's often not that clear, these things. So let's say you don't do those things. When it comes to, sometimes my husband and I would have conversations about his work. He worked for a retail chain and I worked doing this. And he would say, sometimes I wish I could do some work that was more beneficial in the world. And my feeling, and I wasn't making this up because I like him, although I do, was that if he went to work and if you or I go to work every day with the intention to be helpful to others, to speak kindly or clearly to them, to encourage them to be creative and accomplished and acknowledge what they're good at and that they're smart about certain things. If we can do that in the workplace, we're doing good work in the world. So, and P.S., he was good at those things. When you go to work, now this is scary. Work is scary because it involves livelihood and survival and cash money and, you know, wanting to live inside and eat food. Those things are pretty much dependent on our livelihood, so it can get very charged, understandable. But as much as possible, when you go into your workday, begin with some kind of generosity, first toward yourself, and then toward the people you encounter. Even if you work in your house by yourself, at some point you're going to send an email or talk to someone on the phone. In the way that you interact there, can you be generous? And I believe that you can. So in the classical Buddhist view, generosity takes three forms. There's a lot of numbers here, so I hope you like numbers. The first form of generosity in the classical sense is somebody needs something, you try to help them get it. If they're cold, you say, hey, would you like to wear my sweater? Or if they run out of pencils, you're like, would you like a pencil of mine? Just the ordinary things. Do you want to share resources with people who you feel comfortable doing so with? That's the first form of generosity. The second form of generosity is called giving the gift of fearlessness, which is really great and super generous. And in the workplace, that can mean something like what I was just saying earlier. Can you encourage others? Can you encourage yourself? Because it always begins with yourself. Can you point out what went right, not only what went wrong? Can you share true compliments, not fake ones, with people who did something well? That helps people be less afraid. We're not talking about babysitting here. My personal view of the Dharma, for what it's worth, is, as a teacher anyway, is I'm not here to take care of anybody, but I'm here to care about everybody. So that's what I mean by giving the gift of fearlessness. You don't have to babysit, you don't have to take care of someone, but you can care about their experience. And that in itself is a channel for fearlessness. Don't take my word for that, you know, or anything. See what happens for you when you do these things. And then the third and final form of generosity here is called giving the gift of Dharma, or of wisdom, knowledge. Can you share your insights? Can you share what you have learned with people that are newer at what you're doing? Can you offer the results of your experience so that others can benefit from it? Those are really good things. And those things, you know, tend to turn any job into right livelihood. I guess there's one more thing I want to say about livelihood, because it's really connected, obviously, to cash money. And cash money is very important because, as mentioned, I would like to live inside and I would like to eat food. So in order to do those things, I have to have money. It sometimes gets confused or conflated. Sometimes it's easy to conflate spirituality or working in wellness or spiritual support, whatever you might call it, and not charging money for it. So I get that. And there is a long, long, long history of great teachers offering endless generosity, giving everything they have, and asking for nothing in return. And I thank them, because I wouldn't be here talking to you without them. And sometimes, you know, am I doing right livelihood? You know, I ask myself that all the time as a teacher, and, you know, I hope so, but every day is a different sort of experiment in right livelihood. Sometimes throughout my work in the Open Heart Project, people have gotten angry at me, which I really don't like, for charging money for some things in the Open Heart Project. Not this. This is free. This has been free for 8 years. As long as I keep doing it, it will be free, as far as I know right now. But there are other, I have to live inside and so on. So when this became my full-time job, because there was such a beautiful response to these videos, basically, I had to figure out how to make a living from it. So we have the Open Heart Project Sangha. That is a paid membership, $27 a month. 6 years ago, it was $27 a month. You know, I'm not trying to gouge anyone, but I want to be successful and I want to make a living and so on. And we have courses and I teach retreats and blah, blah, blah. And money is charged for those things. Now, it doesn't happen as much anymore, but it happens that I get a little side eye for that. Are you really a spiritual teacher if you're charging money? And, you know, I don't know. I'm doing my best, but I'm not going to tell you I am or I'm not. It's up to you to figure out, do these teachings benefit you? Which I hope they will. So when Buddhism, and this is a little off topic, but bear with me, when Buddhism arrives at new shores, interestingly, and I would say unlike other spiritual traditions, as far as I know, the Dharma meets the pre-existing culture and is changed by the pre-existing culture and changes the pre-existing culture to some degree. So when Buddhism, and this is, I'm not a scholar, so I pretty much think this is right. When Buddhism went from India, where it started, to Japan, it met the Shinto tradition and took on the flavors and forms of that tradition. When it went to China, it met Chan, and same thing happened. When it went to Tibet, it met the Bun tradition, same thing. And now it's here. You know, maybe for 50, 75 years. What is it meeting? And now this is very germane to livelihood, if you ask me, and I'll tell you why in a second. I would say that our dominant culture is not necessarily the Judeo-Christian religions, although there are people who are trying to make it be that way. I would say the values that govern our culture, maybe some of them are from Judeo-Christian traditions, but they are mostly from consumerism, is my opinion. So here we are, consumerist culture, the Dharma is here. Buddhism is mixing with consumer culture and is being changed by it, not the teachings, but the way it's offered. And then this is my hope, it can change the dominant culture, because these things tend to be work in both directions. So my hope is that some of these values, of course, starting with right livelihood, can mix with our culture, which we can't pretend is not consumerist, because it is. You got to pay for things and so on. Can it influence the way business is transacted, the way money changes hands, the way we value each other? I'm going with yes. Might not be in my lifetime, but nonetheless, it's possible. And P.S., most of the teachings in the, you know, great, in most of the history of Buddhism was offered by monastics who lived inside and had food. They were provided by the community. So in this culture, there are no such provisions for people that do work like me and maybe you. So anyway, I'm going far afield. Right livelihood. Don't work as best you can. Try not to do work that harms others, that traffics in weapons or poisons. And bring your spirit of generosity into the workplace as best you can, because we all have grumpy days and so on. And remember that you can be generous with in ordinary ways by giving things to people that need them, if you can afford to, or even if you can't sometimes. Trying to support others to be more fearless in their self-expression and in the work they do, and sharing your wisdom with others for their benefit, not to, you know, showboat. So again, the practice of meditation creates the ground for all of these 8 steps. So let's do it. We're going to sit. Begin, as always, by forgetting everything I just said and everything you thought about what I just said, and notice where you are. Here you are. Right here. This is what's going on. Establish your posture by sitting up straight and letting the hands rest on the legs, palms down. Tune in for a moment to the strength of your back body. It's powerful. And tune in for a moment to the softness and tenderness of your front body. The belly is soft, the area around the heart. Front body is soft, the back body is strong, and they are inseparable from each other, obviously, and so it is on an inner level as well. Let the shoulders soften. Mouth is closed, but the lips and teeth can be slightly parted. The breath is natural in and out through the nose, unless you have a cold. But just keep breathing as you have been since the moment you were born. No further instruction is required. And we want to feel the body breathing rather than observe the body breathing. So we go even more deeply within to feel our breath rather than taking a little energetic step out to look back at ourselves. Just feel. Feel the in-breath and the out-breath. The eyes are open, and the gaze is soft and cast down to a comfortable spot in front. And let there be a sense that rather than laser pointing at something with your vision streams from the eyes like the rays of the sun, and like the rays of the sun mixes with space. Inseparable from space, rather than focusing on one thing in particular. You're just sitting there with your eyes open. Simpler way of saying it. Let the brow relax. Continue to feel the body breathing. Your mind, of course, will continue to make thoughts, no big deal. That's what it does. There's no off switch particularly, nor does there need to be one. Thoughts are not a problem. Let your primary attention be on the breath and see if you can allow thoughts to sort of recede into the background like your thoughts made the sound of a stream running by your house or your apartment or wherever you live. It just burbles. But we're right here. While that is also happening, all of your thoughts will come and go, period. So no need to intercede, unless you get carried away by thought, meaning you jump in the stream. And you know you're carried away by thought when you realize you've lost all awareness of your breath. Excellent. You spaced out. Cool. Now you know it. Notice that. You can label that moment silently, thinking, then just let go. Like thought was a little feather that you had in a closed fist and you just opened the fist. And it just blows away. Bring your attention back to this breath, this very one, and begin again, feeling the body breathe. So we'll sit together in silence for a few minutes until you hear the bell. Thank you so much for your practice. It really matters. Thank you for practicing with me. And thank you for practicing together with all the other people in the world who are meditating right now. May our practice benefit all beings.